Okay, right, well, it's 12:05, so we'll make a start. Fourth week, third of the way through the module, and we're pretty much approaching the 21st century via the 19th century and the 20th century with this wonderful, magical thing called wireless. Not Wi-Fi, but wireless. This notion of actually transmitting radio forms in ways in which that has had such a massive impact in terms of mass communication, in terms of being a prime media format for the ways in which messages are sent out there for good or ill. And over the course of the next 40-odd minutes or thereabouts, I'll hopefully go through those eight key areas demonstrating how the telegraph kind of paved the way for the first real use of telecommunication or communication over large-scale areas between countries, between continents in certain areas. And we'll talk a little bit about, I suppose, the analogues of Gutenberg and his colleagues, obviously William Caxton in Britain and so on, some of the names of the people who were really involved with setting up this whole notion of where radios come from and how it's developed. We look at some of the kind of issues that actually suggested that if it hadn't been for the intransigence of the Marconi Company in particular, maybe a lot more lives would have been saved on the Titanic, because actually they simply stuck with a system that actually was outdated and effectively didn't prove to be fit for purpose on that night to remember in 1912. And there are other areas that relate to that, which also lead to legislation, the ways in which people actually work with legislation, how governments react to this area where, on the one hand, it's free speech. It's speech for everybody to actually talk about anything they want to. Well, that might be fine in theory, but in practice, what if that free speech becomes blatant propaganda for a particular cause, be that anti-Semitism, be that National Socialism, be it any of the kind of slightly more unsavoury political elements that we've come across in our human history over the last 100, 150 years and so on. We'll talk about Auntie Beeb, as it's referred to, in terms of what British reaction to this was and how British radio came to the fore in the 1920s and continues to obviously be arguably a very important part of our particular culture in creating the notion of what it is to be British. And we'll talk about the equivalent in America and indeed in Britain in terms of commercial radio. Commercial radio didn't start in Britain until the 1970s, 50 years or so after the BBC had been in operation. So we look at the reasons why that was the case, and also running parallel to that from the public relations perspective, how audio, this medium that goes directly from one's voice to God's ears, can actually be such an impactful form, it still tends to be, in terms of persuasion, propaganda and so on. And we'll wrap up by really getting you to think a little bit more about how does radio work in an area or an environment where things like podcasts and radio on demand and listening to radio when you want to listen to it and audio podcasts is actually very much part of the radio ecology. I'm taking a number of things from today's work. Asa Briggs, who actually wrote A Profound History of the BBC, and this time writing with Peter Burke, The Social History of the Media. And also, again, it's worth noting, having a look at Revolutions in Communication, I'm going to take a quote from this, by Bill Kovarik, K-O-V-A-R-I-K, because, again, it actually sums up in two sort of fairly neat and relatively readable texts some of the key points I want to get across today. So let's talk about the telegraph, not the newspaper, but this whole notion of getting communication across a distance. Hugely important. Started off in the middle of the 19th century. So around about the 1850s, when the first messages, just literally using kind of dot, dot, tap, tap thing, long form Morse code came into operation, but a way of actually communicating information, certainly during the American Civil War, about troop movements between the Confederates and the Unionists, because troop movements could be spotted via barrage balloons and balloons that were sort of high on field, etc., and the telegraph was obviously used to connect one particular military base to another military base or commander and so on, and to get messages across from there. So gone were the days where a messenger was actually sent from one area of the battlefields to another, although it still sort of tended to take place. This was a case of technology being able to actually transmit via wires different sources of information. And again, it's an interesting sort of notion, because where does that information come from? What information is being transmitted and so on? Well, by the end of the 19th century, transatlantic cables have been laid between, obviously, the New World, North America, the United States of America, this brand spanking new nation which had only been independent from Britain for about 120, 130 years and had its own civil war and so on. It's a way of really connecting across the ocean via cable. No cable, no telegraph. So the big challenge with respect to the telegraph was obviously, well, how do we actually move on from that? Well, clearly, we need to move to an environment which is wireless. So you need to start transmitting. So what's fitting together? Did anybody do physics at GCSE or science level? You did? Oh, GCSE, right, okay, excellent. Well, it's not really a physics lesson, but basically, electromagnetism. People kind of know, we all know what electricity is. We don't quite know how to explain it in terms of, well, why is it you switch a light on, you get this effect and so on. But one of the key things about lightning storms is a lightning strike is a discharge of electricity from the earth to the sky and so on. So it's a range of sort of elements that are coming across with that. And people such as Benjamin Franklin and his peers, his supporting staff, were really interested in terms of how this was working. How can we actually sort of use this sort of strange, bizarre activity? And there was one particular event that took place in around the middle of the 19th century where the equivalent of the Aurora Borealis was seen right across the Northern Hemisphere. Played havoc with telegraphs, played havoc with all sorts of other pieces. It was caused, latterly we found out, only about 50 or 60 years ago, by massive solar flares. Solar flares, not great for electromagnetic communication. It's a bit like if you've got a mobile phone and you have an electromagnetic pulse, it'll take the system out completely. This was like a big phenomenon that sort of people thought, it's the end of the world, it's not happening, and so on and so forth. Heinrich Hertz was one of the key folk who was quite interested in terms of how batteries and how elements could actually be used to connect with this whole side of things. And what sort of messages were actually there? So was Origi. So was Ivan Popov, who was a Russian conspirator, and probably the father of them all in many ways, although he wasn't around. I hope I got the pronunciation right. You can correct me on this one, Rebecca. Guglielmo Marconi. G-U-G-L-A-L-A-I. Guglielmo. Guglielmo Marconi. Who actually was quite fortunate, because he actually married an heiress to a range of sort of fortunes in Britain, and sort of that helped him kind of with his studies, with his work, etc., in terms of electromagnetism or the electromagnetic spectrum and how things were working within that whole field. And Marconi certainly was ahead of the game in terms of putting together this whole medium of wireless telegraphy. In other words, transmitting using transmitters across distances, what previously could only be connected via wires. It's a big step forward there in terms of how things are going and what's happening, etc. So, the first question to consider today is that, well, maybe, if I'll take it from a rhetorical point of view, we'll talk more about this tomorrow, it's that whole excitement of hearing voices without seeing them, and hearing voices which are coming from different towns, from different cities, from different countries. If you look at what's happening in late Victorian England and America at this time, you see huge growth in things like spiritualism. Because after all, if you can communicate with other people from different countries without seeing them, why can't you communicate with people who have gone to other levels of being, or who have transcended our life experience and happen to be in a different world?
There's also a range of aspects that come across from this whole notion of the scientific revolution, the sort of science-based thing we've talked about in this module before, where lots of science is going out to the fore. There's a sort of understanding of what's taking place. But it's also that notion of suddenly voices coming from where, from what. It's a kind of magical element, and yet it's understandable because we know that actually these things are working. You can actually type out an SOS code, you can develop various elements of these. There are still challenges, and for a long time, AM, or amplifier, or the AM wave band is considered the preferable way forward. It's a long time before we move on to frequency modulation, FM, and indeed our current sort of digital work and scenario. But these are times where you can communicate with ships, you can connect with this. You won't recognise this particular image, but he is actually Dr. Crippen. You might have heard of him, you might have seen Madame Tussauds. You might have actually sort of encountered him. Mass murderer, killer, sort of did a whole range of sort of untold for of things with acid in baths and various other things, and went off. He thought he'd escaped everything because he left the country, went to America, but because of telegraphy, the captain of the ship that he actually sort of sailed on was made aware of his presence, so that when he actually arrived in America, he was arrested. It's the first case of where you've got everything, haven't you? You've got your death, you've got your victims, you've got your crime, you've got your sex, you've got your, are they going to get away with it, and you've got your rightful justice at the end. It's like the Harvey Weinstein of the current day, except I don't think Harvey's killed anybody. Although he might have, who knows? Killed some careers anyway, still. In terms of that, clearly for mass media forms like the press, it's fantastic. This is at a time where you've got an editor called W.T. Stead, S-T-E-A-D, who's very much using what he's referring to as new journalism to really mass produce and mass popularise papers. Newspapers are being read for a number of key things: sport, local politics, but also, from Stead's point of view, sex and scandal. Absolutely fantastic. It's the way in which messages are being put out from that point of view. And this is the way in which, obviously, you've got cases of new technologies fitting in with existing mass media formats to really develop an output, which is actually, it's a win-win situation for both parties. Because you're actually getting the scenario whereby, you've got stories that people are sort of lapping up and saying it's fantastic and all's well with the world. Although it isn't. Because in 1912, the unsinkable sinks. Why? Why did we actually have this whole situation going? Well, we know why. It ran into an iceberg. But why was it that you had a number of ships that were in the area that didn't report that there was an iceberg? Well, actually, they wanted to, but they couldn't because they were using radio transmitter sets which were not fit for purpose. They couldn't get the signal across. You could only actually communicate on the basis of the person you were speaking to had to stop transmitting in order for you to effectively transmit. If you've ever heard any radio pieces or any sort of routines, you know when people say over? And all the war films say da 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 da, over? That over is meant to say, right, I've stopped, now you can speak. Marconi and his device didn't actually allow that to happen. Okay, it allowed it to happen, but it didn't allow sort of messages to get across. So ships were trying to, and the inquiry at the end, if you ever read any of the transcripts of what actually happened, ships have been trying to actually contact the Titanic, so you do realise you're heading to an iceberg. Didn't get the message until obviously it was too late. I mean, there's a posthumous award for the final telegrapher on the Titanic, who actually sort of stayed at his post right until the ship actually sank. But in the subsequent details and the debrief, the decision was made that actually, if they had incorporated the latest incarnations of radio devices that had been sort of put together and developed, then actually the majority of passengers would probably have been saved. I suppose you could say if you had a Back to the Future, you could go back, change time, do all sorts of bits and pieces. But frustrating, but nevertheless, again, it brought to the public consciousness, not only the fact that technology was there, not only the fact that radio was here to stay, but also it was changing, it was evolving, it was changing into new forms, etc. It was also, from the case of America, being used for entertainment in the sort of early teens, so 100 years or so from now, you're seeing the beginnings of radio sets. Now, Marconi and Hertz, and a number of other sort of folk who are actually working with the whole system, were enthusiasts. They were good amateurs, they were working through a whole process. And it was, again, it was an interesting line in terms of people saying, well, this is the radio is great for sending messages. It's great for saving lives. But that's boring. How is it going to tap into, what's the killer application going to be between where we are with this radio system and entertainment? What about playing music on the radio? Shock. Think about that. This is a whole range of things here. But then, why not? Sarnoff, who was the founding member of ABC, and well, actually NBC and CBS in America, David Sarnoff, S-A-R-N-O-F-F, was very keen on actually exploiting radio for its entertainment value. Again, there's the sort of sense that, well, how are we developing the whole notion of radio as an entertainment when actually it needs to be sort of there for culture and various other factors? But it was quite clear that for a variety of reasons, radio was with us. It was going to stay. It, in the early part of the 20th century, was probably the equivalent of Bebo, MySpace, Facebook, gradually sort of bits and pieces. Again, it was evolving. It was changing around on a constant basis. We knew that if you just restricted it to enthusiasts, you would have the basic radio sets, which are fairly straightforward to set up. But when it's seen as being a mode of entertainment by people like David Sarnoff and colleagues and the United States government and others, and other media owners in the press and so on, clearly you need to have some sort of control to actually license what is actually being sent out there. It's not, well, it is sort of similar to printing presses. If you go back to the history of printing, there's a long time where it took, the government were very reluctant to issue licenses to print, and so you get illegal printing taking place and a variety of other factors. But the first licensees of transmitters and receivers tended to take place in the 1911 through to 1920s. Why a license to receive? Well, the BBC license, which of course includes a radio now, used to have one license for radio and one license for television. Because that was a way in which you could make money. If you want to listen to your favourite musicians, your favourite performers, your favourite plays, you know, what are the kind of drivers? If we look at Sky Sports, they're driven by sport, arguably primetime TV shows and so on, a number of other areas are actually there. Why would people want to buy a receiver? Well, vaudeville, or the theatre, big business, right? People have more leisure time. They want to do more things with their leisure time. So what better way than actually having a radio receiver in your family home where you can actually listen to stuff that's going on? That might be sports commentaries, it might be listening to concerts, popular music, whole radio other bits and pieces. So again, you're licensing two things. First of all, a license for the program maker to transmit, and then secondly, a license for somebody to actually receive what's there. Now you say, what's the equivalent? Well, hands up if you've got a Netflix subscription. Yeah, hands up if you've got an Amazon Prime subscription. Exactly. Sky? Same thing. You know, what you're paying there is, in essence, sort of, again, you could argue it's a tax on the sort of thing that it doesn't be completely free of charge if they wanted to, but no, they're a multi-million dollar industry. They want to actually develop things from that point of view. And this is where very much the thing actually has its roots. So I've kind of already begun to answer this question in terms of, if we've actually got media developments occurring in radio, as we are currently within the web, the internet, and so on, again, from Gutenberg to Google, you've got a similar kind of thing occurring with respect to, again, that whole growth of print across Europe. That growth of print, which kind of saw print being developed as a way of spreading knowledge, spreading information, and, as I've also said, spreading entertainment,
maybe that concept of infotainment, information entertainment, portmanteau word, infotainment, also connects. Big difference is the amount of time it actually took. If you bear in mind that press came in at around about, the movable type printing press by Gutenberg, the end of the 15th century, it kind of took about 300 years for it to really become massively sort of part of people's lives. Radio and the telegraph did it in about 70 years. Arguably that's compressed even further now in terms of the way that technology comes in and how it's developed. Scary. Oh no, what's happening? Well,
in Britain, seeing what's happening in the States is a fairly critical way of saying, well, do we want to go that way, or do you want to go a completely different direction? Broadly speaking, in the United States, if you had sufficient capital or money behind you, you could set up a radio station and transmit. Okay, you didn't have to go through any other key things. You could also, shock horror, sell advertising space on your station. So you're into this whole notion of radio being best used as a device that is used to deliver audiences to advertisers. Really important point. Radio delivering audiences to advertisers. Why is it important? Because if you actually are then charging for airtime, say a 30-second ad, a one-minute ad, a program sponsorship and so on, clearly, if you've got a massive audience of several million, you can charge more for the company who's actually taking out advertising space. Now, there is a flaw with program sponsorship and advertising. Who then actually controls the quality and quantity of the program? Do you get, as occurred in the United States in the 1930s, a well-known Catholic priest called Father Coughlin, C-O-U-G-H-L-I-N, who spends about 10 years, well actually about 4 or 5 years, saying Adolf Hitler is the best person on this planet, he's absolutely right, the Jews are wrong, and go on. And actually, well, after a number of broadcasts, people understandably were as shocked by Father Coughlin as they would probably be by Donald Trump today. But in terms of the sort of focus, clearly from that point of view, if you are sponsoring that program, if it's a controversial output, you might not want to have your product associated with it. Now, looking ahead slightly to next week when I start talking about television, one of the examples where you'd have to say that's the other extreme is where a writer called Rod Serling, who developed Twilight Zone, which celebrates its 60th anniversary 2 years' time from now, he actually was once told by a gas company that he could not make reference to any of the gas chamber scenarios of Auschwitz, because it might offend people who are interested in buying an NEC product. Difficult sort of line to actually take. In Britain, there's also concern from the press barons, Lord Beaverbrook, and various other owners of the Daily Mail, the Daily Express, and so on, who are selling massive circulation, or have massive circulations at this time, that radio news will mean that people won't buy the newspapers, because they'll get all the news from radio. So politically, there are lots of pressure groups whereby the government are faced with a number of influential press editors saying that the only way in which we're going to support radio is if you actually limit news bulletins to one bulletin per day, and that not to be actually transmitted before 7 p.m. in the evening. So for the first decades, pretty much, of BBC, which started broadcasting in 1922 and then became British, well, it started broadcasting as a British broadcasting company in 1922 with John Reith as the Director General, and then became the British Broadcasting Corporation 5 years afterwards in 1927. That was after a sort of 5-year period in which the government said, actually, yes, so it's okay. But there were a number of key areas. In order for the BBC to be funded by the taxpayer, through initially the post office buying radio licences, and then becoming effectively the BBC licence fee, no commercials, and pretty much very little news.
a quite considerable period, actually. It wasn't really until the 1930s that the BBC started developing a news department. It used to have what was called the talks department, but it wasn't really, and it's certainly what we recognise as a news department as yet. Now that, again, came primarily from John Reith's overall views in terms of what he saw the BBC as being. John Reith was a Scotsman, very much a Calvinist. He saw very much the BBC had a clear role, which kind of echoes some of the things we've seen in the States. It was to inform, to educate, and to entertain. And those three words are right at the heart of all the sort of BBC stuff, including Broadcasting House and various other sort of aspects and so on, that to inform, to educate and to entertain were at the heart of what the BBC was actually doing. So you've got these three models that really impact in terms of how we see radio being used in the world. Some countries, North Flag, etc., but some countries will say it's completely run by the government. The government will actually look after our radio transmitters. If you happen to be in the Soviet Union, or indeed Russia, or any of the sort of post-1917-18, or Russia, totally controlled by the government. Pravda, which translates as the truth, is effectively all the messages, all the information you get, comes through the government. The other side of the continuum, the other side of the Atlantic, government really doesn't want to get involved with any kind of legislation or indeed censorship, unless they're forced to, as was the case, as I mentioned, with Father Coughlin. And well, actually, there was another highly popular show called the Amos and Andy Show. Two white blokes pretending to be two African-American cab drivers, replete with fake accents the lot. Even at the time, people were actually saying, this is racist, this is just, what are you doing? But because it was so popular, and you can access it on YouTube, or the Amos and Andy Show, it was bringing the adverts, bringing the sponsors, they needed to change it. It actually translated to television, didn't work quite well, eventually it was sort of canned in the 1950s. But if you want to be, think, what were they thinking, check out the Amos and Andy Show. Britain has not been immune to that. The Black and White Minstrel Show on television lasted for a good 20 or 30 years. It's peak time viewing. Lenny Henry actually said, when he was the sole black person, and basically the Black and White Minstrel Show, you had a lot of white singers, white male singers, who would black up and pretend to be African-American singers. Bizarre, still. But at the same time, in America, commercial interests tended to rule. And then finally, at the same time, you have this notion of a public service broadcasting thing. Now, this is crucial because the government are quite clear that they will actually license the BBC, but the BBC will remain editorially independent. It's one of the reasons, whether it's election time or any time there's any sort of controversy, you get either Labour or left-wing or Conservative or right-wing people saying, accusing the BBC of bias. Kind of like a no-win situation. Because in any way, shape, or form, Brexit, classic case in point. The BBC is all against Brexit, the BBC is all for Brexit, etc. It's very much a case that, actually, again, it's somewhere in between, but the idea is that as a public service, it's designed to effectively provide something which is simply maintaining its own integrity and reflecting the state of broadcasting as we see it in the country. So does that mean commercial radio doesn't do that at all? Does that mean commercial radio says, oh, the heck with everything, as long as we don't offend too many people, we can be as shocking as you like, we can bring on Chris Moyles and Russell Brand and a whole heap of other sort of folk and really start sort of going for the jugular, etc.? Well, not exactly, because that tends to lead to all sorts of problems. Let's go back a little bit to the 1930s and the power of the medium. In 1938, on October 31st, 1938, a very, very famous American radio broadcast took place. It was directed by the Mercury Theatre Company, headed up by a chap you might have heard of called Orson Welles. And he did an adaptation of H.G. Wells, no relation, War of the Worlds. But the Mercury Radio Company ran it as though it was a real docudrama happening. that actually the Martians were landing, and effectively we went through the whole sort of circuit. There was no time, any place during the actual audio play itself, and you can listen to it again where they mention you're listening to a dramatisation, etc. It was a real thing. Result, huge panic, particularly in Jersey for some reason. New Jersey, as opposed to Jersey, America, as opposed to Jersey over here. Couldn't quite believe that. When a similar experiment actually took place, well, it wasn't an experiment, when a similar thing took place in 1949 in Peru, the public got so angry they went and shot several members of the radio station. Because they thought it was so brave. So, you know, you play with fire, you play with sort of stuff going out there, you can find yourself in all sorts of challenging times and various other factors. And certainly one of the sort of elements which has emerged over the last two or three decades, the emergence of the shock jock and political broadcasters and people who take a particular time, are kind of designed almost deliberately to provoke people. Deliberately designed to irritate and to cause people to actually say, I don't know about this, and so on. So, let's say you happen to be in the National Socialist Party in 1938 and you already managed to secure a kind of deal by which Chamberlain has effectively said that's okay, you can have part of Czechoslovakia and have this the Sudetenland as long as we have peace in our time. And look, I've got a piece of paper to actually prove it. It's often been said that actually what Hitler did, which Churchill didn't, was Hitler not only used the radio, but he also made huge use of the television, or the early television screen, the cinema screen. Certainly Leni Riefenstahl, who was the documentarian, who did the majority of sort of Third Reich propaganda together with Goebbels and so on, was very much looking to sort of address this whole point. The one land, one folk, one Lied, ein Volk, ein Land, ein Führer, the whole notion of what Hitler was actually saying. But on the reverse of the situation, after Chamberlain had effectively been eased away from office, and clearly the war had broke out in 1939, Churchill, his radio speeches were viewed as actually being absolutely vital to keeping the nation morale together, and also indirectly in terms of getting America to join the Allied forces and actually finally actually change the direction of the Second World War. Now, there is an argument that said, yes, well, America only really came in after Pearl Harbor and the Pearl Harbor Japanese attack and so on. But that also negates something else that was happening insofar as American broadcasters were sending people like Edward R. Murrow and company over to Britain to effectively commentate on the situation here, do the live feedback. So there was that notion of news and the immediacy of news coming through to actually work through that. In other words, we're getting to this whole notion of the effects of radio. Whether those effects happen to be from a sort of fictional basis, October 31st and War of the Worlds and so on, or whether they happen to be from actually reporters actually in situations where they're reporting on war, they're reporting people being shot, so that you're seeing that whole notion of where things are going. In Britain, we'd actually had examples of this with Richard Dimbleby, who was the father of David Dimbleby and Jonathan Dimbleby. And Richard Dimbleby did a live report on air from a phone box, actually outside Crystal Palace, as Crystal Palace was being burnt to the ground, the Crystal Palace Exhibition Centre, not the football club. So it was a 0-0 draw that he got on Saturday, so that's all right, isn't it? Crawley, in case you're wondering, that's who runs the town play. Every week I was trying to squeeze at least one reference to Grimsby Town. I think it's important. But again, in terms of that whole aspect, you've got the notion of the immediacy, putting the audience into the action, actually reporting live from the event, whether that happens to be, as I say, a sporting occasion, a national disaster, or whatever. You have these connections coming through on that basis. And so if we start talking about those particular connections, you get what I'm pretty much going to say relates to centripetal forces of radio. Centripetal forces of radio. What's the best way to demonstrate centripetal force? And you can tell me whether or not you've ever done this. Take one bucket fill with water, attach it to a sort of general rope, and swing it round and round and round as fast as you can, and hopefully the water will not come out. Anybody want to try that experiment?
Yeah.
To varying degrees of success. The idea is that basically, once you get the right thing moving around, the centripetal force will actually pull the thing together. In other words, it will unite the nation, as opposed to centrifugal force, which will pull it apart. And how does it actually go into uniting the nation? Well, it gives you a platform to share information. Absolutely vital. It also gives you a sense of what we refer to as the spreading of national culture. And we'll listen in a few moments to an example of that, where again it's taken at height of wartime. There was a lot of debate, certainly during the Second World War, 1939 to 1945, in terms of what should the BBC actually be doing. Because right at the start of when war was declared, the first thing the BBC did was stop its television immediately. Television was kind of around, as we'll find next week, from about the mid-30s onwards as a sort of system. There was one channel that went through that. It came to an end in September 1939. The apocryphal tale is basically it literally stopped right in the middle of a Mickey Mouse cartoon, Steamboat William, picked up again in 1946 with the same cartoon, so a slight interruption on that basis. Interesting that it was an American product that was being transmitted on British television at the time. That's another sort of issue. But the decision needed to be made, were they actually going to decide on just the news, or were they also, bearing in mind morale issues, going to start looking at what did people actually want here? Did they want to maintain some sort of normality? What was the home front like? And sure enough, comedy programmes and elements that connected within that began to emerge as well, in terms of, again, keeping sort of people's spirits high and so on and so forth. That's quite an interesting one, because if you listen back through YouTube packages, through what we're going to hear today, you kind of have maybe three accents that you get on the BBC radio. You get received pronunciation, a frightfully sort of posh scenario of actually going through this, say, what a delicate thing. You get the Cockney slur, oh, Kennedy, now love, and the sort of the various other bits. So you get the working class, you get the upper class, etc. And occasionally you might get some sort of Scottish or regional Welsh accent coming through with that. But you still get this notion of kind of national accent, hence the term, the phrase that's often used, BBC English. Sort of way that's often sort of centric on that approach. But inevitably, you get this notion of some kind of commonality, a sort of general commonality in the language that we're actually using and how things are being used, etc. Talked about centripetal, clearly the reverse of that, as I said, is centrifugal. And you could argue that we're kind of living through that at present. 150 channels and nothing on. There's so much choice that you've actually got, in other words, so much variety, that actually the notion of what we used to call water cooler moments, in other words, did you see so-and-so last night? Did you see this? They're very much more restricted. Possibly restricted to things like mass sporting events, like the Olympic Games, the World Cup, or various other sectors where people might have sort of had a shared experience. But there is this privatisation. People actually consume media in terms of what you want to go to. You know, I talked about subscription. I mean, I guarantee we might have some commonality in terms of people actually follow through the notion that they'll access the same sort of things on Netflix and other sort of areas and see how that develops. But you'll also find that will displace the notion of kind of common sort of environment and work within the whole field. So, it's a phrase to take away. One of many, hopefully, today, which we can talk about tomorrow. Radio. The medium of intimate distance. This is a quote from a writer called Lessig, Lawrence Lessig, actually, who's a Harvard University law professor. And Lessig actually was very much at the heart of saying that it was wrong for record companies to take legal action against people who actually downloaded music, quote-unquote, illegally. Big sort of moment in terms of where things are going, in terms of MP3s and so on. And I'll just read you out what Lessig actually says in terms of his statement for this. We come from a tradition of free culture. Now, bear in mind, he's American, so he's looking at this particular aspect. Not free as in free beer, but free as in free speech, free markets, free trade, free enterprise, free will and free elections. A free culture is not a culture without property, just as a free market is not a market in which everything is free. The opposite of a free culture is a permission culture, a culture in which creators get to create only with the permission of the powerful or of creators from the past. So Lessig's really kind of raising that sort of bar there in terms of, well, shouldn't knowledge be free? Shouldn't entertainment be free? Shouldn't we actually open up sort of various other areas? I mean, clearly the models, the economic models that British Telecom, BT Sports, again, it's interesting, radio, there's a wonderful photograph, I'm actually must include it on the slides, I'll bring it out tomorrow, in 1922, which is believed to be the last photograph taken while he was alive of Alexander Graham Bell. And he's actually listening to the radio through his headphones. It's quite interesting. BT Sports, or BT Digital Services, and Sky generally agree that they're probably going to have to rethink the next package of league rights and so on, because you will get people like Amazon Prime and Netflix possibly saying, we'll buy some of that. We'll give you an offer of several billion. I don't know how these Premiership footballers manage to exist on the sort of pennies that they have to work through. 160,000 a week, it's nothing, is it really? It's shush, it's gone. How does it actually relate to the way in which we sort of connect with radio? Well, the days when probably we would gather around the radio set and all listen to the radio, they might have existed in certain sort of halcyon days, but mostly folk will actually listen individually, whether you're actually sort of celebrating individually because your team scored or whatever, or your athletes sort of work through that. Or car radios. Most people, and again, we sort of test this, etc., if they listen to radio at all these days in terms of transmitted radio, will listen to it when they're in a car. It's rare that folk use this wonderful sort of 1950s Bakelite to actually listen to it at home. Even the sort of days and the growth of the teenager, which was vital to the pop culture in the 1950s, 1960s, perhaps less so. iPods, yes, but again, that's sort of shifting in terms of listening habits and so on. However, the medium of intimate distance, from sender to receiver, the model continues. It's not mediated by any kind of interference, like images or data or other sort of areas, or even if you're reading a newspaper, you put your set of headphones on and you can listen directly to what's being said all over again, whether you're listening to a podcast, a public relations lecture, or whether you're listening to various other aspects, you can still get that one-to-one connection, which makes it still quite unique as a medium for development and work through. Now, I wanted to actually wrap up with this little excerpt from Mrs. Mop Joins the Home Guard. And actually, we might play this tomorrow because time's a bit tight today. Two sort of aspects here. One of which is the sort of formal version of J.B. Priestley, a fairly well-known English poet and writer who was commenting on the small works of Dunkirk. Anybody see Dunkirk this year? Okay, that's good. Well, again, this is the sort of live one. Some didn't, etc. And then there's this one from 1943 when, as I said, the notion was, let's maintain some sort of form of normality. Bear in mind as you listen to this other sequence some of the aspects relating to accent, culture, and so on. And this is obviously a shot taken from the studio of It's That Man Again, Tommy Handley. And,
hello, folks. It's That Man Again, Tommy Handley, to get to you about something you can all do to help the war.
Well, folks, now I want to talk to you, but hello, Mrs. Mott, what do you want?
I've brought this for you, sir.
Now, isn't that nice of you? What is it? Not one of your daughter's discards, I hope.
No, sir. It's a letter from the government, sir.
Well, send him to my terminus for the ticket. It's the tax collector. Tell him I'll give him an IOU.
Aren't you going to read it, sir?
Well, I suppose I better. Now, what's this? Well, it isn't the tax collector at all. It's the government calling all mayors. Now, what does it say? I am asking you, as the civic head of a community, to use every effort to make your citizens realise the need for fuel economy. Mrs. Mott, you delicious old dust fiber, it's a call to duty. And shall it be said that the mayor foaming at the mouth was wanting in public spirit?
No spirit.
Not that kind of spirit, you old brush barrister. Don't you realise, Mrs. Mott, that you've a Tommy gun in your gasoline?
I never put it there, sir. I swear I never.
Yes, and what's more, there's a bomb in your sink and a couple of rifles in your gas fire.
True, sir. Shall we call out the Home Guard?
Home Guard, it blows. You must be the Home Guard, you old flat duster.
What, me, sir? I'd rather join the West.
Now it's the Home Guard for you. This letter said before we've got to be careful. I mean careful. Every bit of gas we save in the home means more gas and coal to make munitions in the factories. You see what I mean, you charming char? Guard against waste, and you'll be making munitions in your own home.
What, me? Me making munitions, sir?
Yes, you and me and everybody else. Just by saving gas and other fuels. Don't be a fermenty. Put on 2 pairs of winter woolies and do without a gas fire. Or you can polish mice around and keep warm that way. And be very careful with the old sink.
What, you, sir?
Now, you old carpet crusher, the kitchen sink. Never wash up under a running tap. No tap and run, see? And use less water in your bath. Who wants a bath in winter time, anyhow?
Yes, sir. And what about cooking, sir? Can't I not be a different life anymore?
Well, that's a my point. Have I got to teach you cooking, too? Try to get your trifles, stewing your trotters. And don't use the oven for only one dish. That's the oven, man. Do you understand, you fascinating old faggot?
I've got the idea, sir. Be careful with the gas and we'll help to take a bit of the egg. But what about you, sir? What about the time you waste when you're supposed to be in conference? We get being stuck up on the mantelpiece, warming yourself in front of the gas fire. And the time you leave it blazing away when it is round the corner for
the All right, this is not fit to bargain. I'll do my bit and you'll do yours. And I hope everybody else will follow suit. We'll make him the son he ever heard of bombing at the mouth.
He'll be bombing in the mouth himself soon, sir.
You bet he will. Now, tip up your mop and transfer your shirt into the gas showroom. You'll be able to mop up plenty of useful tips on saving gas there.
Right, so, you firm tip. Get down for now, sir.
Step down with this mop. And remember, don't be foolish.
So there we are. Who needs a bath in winter anyway?
Getting colour points across there. First of all, there's obviously the public information aspect. Don't be foolish. It's a 3-minute piece. It's using celebrities of the time to actually address that whole aspect. And yeah, even getting elements of double entendre and various other sort of elements within that, as well as obviously a reinforcement of the class system. And maybe the BBC actually using a certain touch of irony and hypocrisy in terms of the chap who's actually Tommy Handley sort of making things, and then he's not quite as saintly as perhaps he leads us to believe. What I'd like to do tomorrow in the session is obviously I'll have your sort of final groups and things and identities for your presentation, so we'll talk a bit more about that. But I'd also like to listen to either a podcast or a radio play. That's a radio piece. That's more than about half an hour. And come tomorrow willing to tell me what you made of it. It can be from any of the stations, BBC 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 5, 6 Music, local station, etc. Just get notes of transmission details, listen to it as a podcast, and just come prepared to actually sort of have a talk about how things are operating from that point of view. Anybody got any questions today? We managed to just about squeeze it in there, which is good.